Welcome to the Naughty Child Podcast with me, Richard.
And me, Polly.
I'm the dad.
And I'm the daughter.
Getting called out in the middle of the night to go carve a cow, to do a cesarean.
It's the closest thing to farming you can do in the middle of Bristol.
And then mum put on YouTube and then now it's there for the world to see, so it's great.
England were very chirpy.
And I think I only cried like four times, but they just happened to get all four times on camera, okay?
Locked myself in a procedure room.
Whether it shows something about me or whether it just shows I'm a little bit stupid.
I love people and I love cricket.
Suddenly I'm out on a helicopter because I can go on a glacier.
It's been the longest year ever, hasn't it?
My dog is now called Jimmy Anderson.
So I learned the anthem because I really genuinely thought they would make us sing it.
Polly, I hear you've got big news.
I've got very big news.
Breaking news.
Breaking news. I'm so incredibly excited because a couple of days ago, I booked flights to Australia.
You're going?
I'm on the plane.
To a land down under.
John Lewis, I've made the cut. He's calling me up for the Ashes next year. It's a bit of a premature call up, but it's just so I can prepare. Very much physically. And mentally, to take on the Ashes.
This is the really exciting news that this week, the Ashes, it was revealed the dates and the venues for the Ashes happening in January to February 2025. Tell us more information, Polly.
So it's quite interesting because it's a different layout to the way it worked last summer. So we actually start with the ODI series. It says ODI in Sydney, Melbourne, then Hobart. Then they do the T20 series, Sydney, Canberra, Adelaide. I will say, so the ODI in Sydney is at the North Sydney Oval, but then the T20 is at the SCG. And then the test match, which is the really exciting part, is at the MCG in Melbourne.
Capacity 100,000.
Let's fill it. Let's fill the MCG for a test match.
So this potentially could become the best attended women's sporting event in history.
Yeah, particularly because it is across 4 days. But you would hope that, I presume one of those days is Saturday, I should know that actually, that over the weekend it will really fill up and lots of people will be there, because that is a huge step to host a women's test match at the MCG. It's a shame it's not 5 days, to be fair. You've gone all that way. Oh, it's 4 days. But I think it's a really, really exciting move by Cricket Australia.
It's huge, isn't it? And how exciting will that be if it all comes down to whoever wins the test?
Oh, well, this is what I think is really good about the way they're doing it this time, because we loved the Ashes here last summer, but the thing that was slightly frustrating, I mean, actually, to be fair, it did give the series a very good narrative in that, okay, England have to win every game kind of thing, or it was 5 out of the 6 white ball games. But if you leave the test match to last, I would imagine it would be in the balance. I'd imagine if you win I really hope. But I'm taking from what happened last summer. Obviously, it's very different when you go away to Australia to play the Ashes, but
we might be 12-0 down.
Right, let's not even I don't want to think about that prospect yet. But I think it's really exciting that it finishes with the test.
It's absolutely brilliant, isn't it? And what a step by Cricket Australia. It's almost like they saw what happened in the Ashes last summer and thought, you know, that's really raised the bar.
Yeah.
Let's raise it again.
Yeah.
And the MCG, I mean, that is huge, isn't it? What a platform, what a stage for them to be playing on. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and I'm heading over there, as I mentioned. So I'm hoping to be at every single game. So if anyone would like to hire me and pay me, that'll be really handy. because going to Australia is expensive.
Yes. Yeah, so to our listeners in Australia, if there's a really nice cricket family there that would like someone to stay with them for a few days, Polly is available to eat your food and so on. And if there's anyone that wants Polly to do some work for them in Australia, she's going to be there for a whole month in January and February, then get in touch with the podcast. And Polly is for hire.
I am for hire. I can clean, I can cook.
You're very good at that.
I am very good at that. Specialise in bathrooms and kitchens. So getting contact. A bit of the pink stuff, anything I'm sorted.
You are very good at that, actually, Paul.
Yeah. So I just need a visa first, and then and then I can clean your bathrooms and kitchens. But anyway, we're going to stay in the Southern Hemisphere, I think, because we're going to chat about England, who are on an away tour in New Zealand at the moment.
Yes, and what a good tour it seems to be at the moment for England. Some amazing performances. There's that one game that we've lost, but even that has been quite instructive, I think. Talk us through what you think the highlights are so far.
Yeah, so last time we recorded, I think it was only the first T20 that had been played in Dunedin. So the second one in Nelson, England won by 15 runs. The third one, as you mentioned, England losing by New Zealand winning by 3 runs. But I think that was an interesting one. Obviously, England didn't have a full strength side, as we have mentioned before. And it was kind of not stupid from England, but they could have very easily avoided the situation.
They snatched defeat from the jaws of victory.
Precisely. And again, we've spoken about Holly Armitage going on this tour, and she made her England debut in very interesting circumstances because Sarah Glenn ended up being concussed during the game. So Holly Armitage came on and she was a concussion replacement rather than just a fielding replacement. Didn't have a great debut, but I mean, under the circumstances, there was a lot of pressure on her. Mm-hmm. And it would have been remarkable if she had gone and won the game for England. That would have been the ultimate debut. That would have been the best way to prove to John Lewis that you belong in this team. But it's very unrealistic. And some of the best athletes in the world probably wouldn't be able to do that. So, yeah, the blame can't be put on her. And she's put in a very difficult position. But anyway, England came back and won by 47 runs in the fourth T20. So they've secured the series win. And they play again tonight. As you're listening to this, if you're listening on Friday, it will be the night before. So we would imagine another England win, particularly given Nat Sivabrun, Danny Wyatt, Sophie Eccleston and Alice Capsey are all back from the WPL and are back in the squads. Mai Bushir, though, has been the standout player through the entire series, with the bat scoring 71 and then 91, an impeccable strike rate, and she's become undroppable now. She was playing at three before, and obviously Alice Capsey's come back in, but she hasn't been dropped. She's been moved to open the batting.
Yeah, and hasn't she done well? Absolutely brilliant in that last game, getting 91. Playing really positively and sensibly. She did have, I think in the game we lost, she was out. She tried to ramp and it was a really embarrassingly bad ramp that got her out. But the way she seems to be playing is, as I say, really positive, really sensible, safe cricket. Great strike rate. So striking at 150, doing exactly what you'd want an opening batter to do. In a T20 match, and wow, yeah, she just looks like England's best player.
Yeah, she's played really well, and I think she had quite a good opportunity when Nat Sivabrun, Alice Capsey, etc. weren't in that side, but even when they've come back in, she's continued that. And that 91 was a really nice innings to watch, and she's done really, really well. So it's encouraging ahead of, as you mentioned, the Ashes. It's encouraging to have players, and the World Cup as well, to have players in form and playing really well. So England have got that T20, as I mentioned, tonight, and then they've got 3 ODIs in Wellington and Hamilton. So the ODIs will be interesting to watch because feels like England did very well, obviously, last summer in the Ashes, but it will be a real test of the batting depth.
Yes, yes. One of the worries is that we don't always bat out 50 overs.
Because this positive brand of cricket, inspiring and entertaining, does a lot of the time mean whacking it and getting out, which is kind of okay for the majority of the time in T20s, but of course in 50 over doesn't quite work.
Yes. Worth mentioning, actually, just today England Women A played against New Zealand and absolutely thrashed them by 83 runs in an ODI. Holly Armitage, 120 from not out from 100 balls. Even I can work out the strike rate of that. Freya Kemp, 80 from 63 balls. Paige Schofield, 57 from 26 balls. Strike rate of 219. So absolutely amazing performance by that team. New Zealand in response, all out for 251 from 43 overs. Four wickets there for Rhianna McDonald-Gay. So really, really great performance by that team. Kate Cross played in that game as well, presumably as a little warm-up, getting it after she took a holiday in India.
Wow, that's harsh.
Well, she didn't actually play any cricket, did she?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, she did train, so that's something.
Yeah. So yeah, really, really impressive by the A-team. And it'll be interesting to see if some of those players, you know, maybe not on this tour, but going forward, can be putting a case to be included in the England team next summer. And then ultimately, for the Ashes tour in January 2025. Of course, this is not the only England tour going on at the moment. The under-19s are in Sri Lanka for a triangular tournament with Sri Lanka and Australia. So we say a big hello to all our friends and listeners from the under-19 team in Sri Lanka. We hope you're having an absolutely brilliant time. Saw the footage of you arriving at the airport. It looks a lot of fun. It looks like you're going to have a real challenge on your hands in this tournament.
Yeah, so Sri Lanka have played Australia already. England are playing Australia tomorrow. And Sri Lanka beat Australia by 7 runs, which is a really impressive result. Sri Lanka scored 117 for 6 from their 20 overs, and Australia replying only managed to get 110.
I mean, that is a surprise, isn't it? I say that really not knowing any of the players on either side.
Yeah.
But you would expect, with all the investment and infrastructure in Australian cricket, that they would beat Sri Lanka. But no. In fact, Sri Lanka have been causing surprises left, right and centre in the women's game, haven't they, for the last few months? And what a great result for them.
Yeah, I mean, I look at the Australia squad and there are some familiar names. Amy Smith, friend of the pod, who's, of course, played in WBBL, went to the Under-19 World Cup. Maggie Clark, she was Under-19 World Cup. Not sure if she's played in WBBL because I know she's... I mean, she was, I think, 15 at the Under-19 World Cup, so a couple of years older now. But there are players who are part of quite a robust system and structure in Australia. But it seems that what Sri Lanka are building is working, and hopefully there are many more Chamari Attapattis coming through because... Yeah, that's a really exciting result. I mean, I'd imagine for Australia, it'll take them a bit of time to get used to the conditions, as it will England. Mm-hmm. So I think tomorrow's game is actually a really good game for that. But yeah, very, very exciting that Sri Lanka have started that tournament well.
Yes, yes. So England need to be warned. They are not going to be pushovers by any means. One of the things we talked about last week, which we didn't really go into depth in because we didn't have the information to hand, because this was when we recorded last week, the 100 draft had just happened just minutes before, was those people, professional cricketers, who didn't make it into the 100 draft. And so we've had a little bit of time to go through that, and we reckon there are 27.
Yeah, I think it might be more like 30 or so. I think I've left a couple of names off, but I kind of made a list of names of people who I genuinely think could get 100 contracts. Now, some of them I think are more primed than others. So, of course, there are wildcard spots available. So, 16 spaces left. Obviously, age is a big factor, and I'd imagine a lot of those wildcard spots will go to younger players because people have got the squads they want, pretty much. A lot of these players will be squad players who'll be running the drinks. But you'd imagine that will be good for a younger player to get them experience. So I'll throw some of the names out that I was quite surprised haven't been picked up. So a big one for us, I think we mentioned last week about Abby Freeborn and Georgia Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Two quite big surprises. You've also got Ellie Anderson, Sophie Luff, Fran Wilson, Abtar Maksud, Amara Carr, Jodie Grewcock, Danielle Gregory. We said she's been on the winning side for every single year and now she hasn't got picked up. That's very surprising. Hannah Rainey, Phoebe Turner, Catherine Fraser.
Amy Campbell's one.
Amy Campbell, yeah. Chloe Brewer, Nat Wraith. I'm trying not to repeat myself. Kelly Castle, Charlotte Taylor. So there's a lot of talent among those names that haven't been picked up. And as we say, some of them probably will do from those wildcard picks. But it is quite interesting because also a lot of them aren't middle order right-hand batters who, like, I mean, well, there's nothing wrong with being that, but a lot of them do have a point of difference.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a couple of wicketkeepers in that. And, you know, of course, Birmingham Phoenix have got all the wicketkeepers. Everyone else must be desperate trying to find them. Look no further. You've got Abby Freeborn. You've got a couple of left-handers in there. Again, another wicketkeeper, Nat Wraith. Unless I've completely... I mean, as I say, I did look at... I looked over everything twice, which sometimes it needs a third or fourth look. But Fran Wilson and Sophie Luff, both of them I'm very surprised by.
Yeah.
Particularly Fran Wilson, I mean, former England player, a little bit shocked. You did bring up the point that perhaps they've outpriced themselves.
Again, this comes down to I don't really know how drafts work.
Yeah, but I know players put themselves in higher bands.
So it could be that a player puts herself in one band and had she put herself in a lower band, would have been picked up.
Yeah,
and therefore could still be picked up
precisely
as a wild card. But it seems to be there is a bias towards younger players.
Yeah.
So you gave the example of Charlotte Edwards picking someone in their squad.
So she picked Tilly Courtine Coleman, who I think is maybe 16. She's on, she's on the under-19 tour and she plays in the Southeast Stars Academy. And I think we mentioned last week, I was like, it's a very Charlotte Edwards thing to do, to pick a young player and kind of... I mean, Charlotte Edwards said it herself, like, I bagsied you because I didn't want anyone else to pinch you in the draft. And I don't think anyone else would have gone for her, but it's a Charlotte Edwards thing to get a young player and, I suppose, nurture her and be like, okay, 3 years down the line, you're going to, I mean, it might not be the Vipers team, but, you know, you're going to be in my senior side. I want you to be opening the bowling in the 100 or whatever. So she brings those young players in, and we've seen her do it with Freya Kemp, she do it with Mary Taylor. She gets those young players and is like, I'm going to help you get to the next stage. So, yeah, there is a bit of a bias for younger players. And I think particularly with those lower band spots, I think they will go to younger players. But as I say, we'll see. And it is remarkable that some of these players haven't been picked up yet.
Yes. So we'll see who gets picked up in the wild cards, but I feel kind of sad about it. But the 100 has developed, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And maybe in the first year of the 100, it was quite easy to get a contract and the contracts weren't as lucrative as they are now. But as the game has developed, it's becoming more and more difficult.
Well, this is what we're saying. We're reflecting on the fact that in 2021, there was still COVID restrictions. So it was very different to how it is now. And even looking at the overseas, there were some... In all honesty, there were some rogue picks for overseas because people just had to come in as replacements because people couldn't fly from the other side of the world. And there were a lot of quarantine rules. And also women's cricket was in a very different space. You didn't have the professionalism. You had the, I think it was the first year of pro contracts and there were five per team. So it's in a very, very different space now. And younger players have academies to develop through and all those sort of things. So it has moved on a very long way, but I think particularly this year, and I suppose a little bit last year, it feels like, oh, okay, this is actually very different. Maybe it's because they introduced a draft. I reckon it's because of that, because otherwise I probably wouldn't have batted an eyelid. But yeah, it's all very interesting. But I suppose better players, best quality, that's what you want from franchise cricket.
Yeah, that's right. Have we got a guest this week, Bonnie?
We have got a guest, staying on the theme of, well, going back to the theme, in fact, of Australia. We have probably, I don't know about the I've got in the word, the most expert person in Australian cricket, but we have got someone who knows a lot about cricket all over the world, but specifically Australia.
This is the thing. When we spoke to this person, I just thought...
We are leaving it in suspense, but their name will be on the front of the page. Like, ooh, who's this mysterious... It's Adam Collins.
When we spoke to Adam Collins, I just thought he knows so much stuff.
Yeah.
He really, really, really knows his stuff.
Like encyclopedic. Mm. It's very impressive. So we spoke everything from men's cricket to women's cricket throughout the ages to Afghanistan to the current Australian women's cricket team. There's everything in there.
We shared some sort of dad stories.
Dad,
of,
it was,
of cricket in the olden
days. Yeah, a lot of old man chat, but yeah. I was enjoying it. sit down, it was back in the day. It's great. So enjoy our chat with Adam Collins. Yeah, so how did you first become interested in cricket? How did that all start?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the program. Lovely to be with you guys. My interest in the game, well, I often say it's just in my blood, but I don't mean that in terms of having had family that were especially interested in cricket. Although my dad was there at the Centenary Test in 1977. That's his first experience of being at a test match the day where Rick McCosker walked out with his mummified head, having nearly had it. Well, I think he did have his jaw broken, didn't he, when batting in the second innings. I'm sure, Richard, you could add to that. I'm sure you remember it when you're a youngster. I culturally, being from Melbourne and being from a city that just adores sport, in the winter you do footy, and by footy I mean Aussie rules, and in the summer you do cricket. And that's been the rhythm that my life was set to, or was set to, all the way through my formative years. So as far back as I can remember, the Channel 9 commentary team was my, I guess, babysitter to an extent in the summer, watching everything that played out on television. A different world, really. I mean, it'd be hard for you to appreciate this, Polly, but pre-internet, there were fewer distractions and you just kind of had what you were given on television on the four channels. And in my case, it was usually locked on one of the sporting contests. And in the summer, that was cricket. So I asked for a cricket jumper for, I think, my fifth birthday, which my grandmother knitted for me. I had cricket bats and cricket gloves and balls and all the rest of it. We had a nice little, in the first home that I grew up in, I think we moved when I was six or seven, we had a nice little alleyway which became a de facto cricket pitch for my dad and I, and then my little brother when he came along. And then from there, when I reached those sort of years like 7, 8, 9, it was inevitable that I was going to play cricket, and did from the age you're allowed to in Australia, which is about 9 or 10. And the rest is history, really. It's gone on to become an enduring passion and my profession for the last 10 years as well.
Yeah, this seems very familiar, actually, in terms of my upbringing. So, yeah, I was brought up in Lancashire. So my football team was Preston North End. So in the winter, we'd go and see Preston, and we were season ticket holders there. And then in the summer, we were members at Lancashire and would be down at Old Trafford on a Sunday for the Sunday League, which was this ridiculously short format game of 40 overs a side, which my dad sort of, well, it was a nice thing to take us, me and my brother, to, but yes, it wasn't the proper game, but it all played in whites, of course. And then, you know, there's these innovations came in around that time, you know. So, well, 1977, I was 6 years old, so I don't quite remember that Centenary Test, but I remember the one that was played at Lord's in 1980, which is completely rained off, because then my dad took me to the Oval. They played us some one-day games after that, and so that was the first time I saw England play Australia, was in a one-day game at the Oval in 1980. And, you know, Jeff Boycott was playing, Kim Hughes was playing, you know, that sort of era of players. So yeah, it was very much in my blood growing up as well. Again, I didn't particularly play the game apart from, you know, knocking it around on the park with my family, but just kind of came to a love of the game.
I love hearing about those old Sunday League, and being a Lancashire fan, you probably have great memories of the 70s, well, in your early years anyway, when they were winning the comp time and again. But the P Super, when Proctorshire came to town and they won at 8:30 at night, and people climbing all over the sight screen and all the rest of it. I mean, it looks like exactly how we'd like domestic cricket to look now, right? With packed houses and people fully engaged and so on. But I guess at the same time, it's a different era.
And maybe there's a bit time. there's a bit of a false memory syndrome, I think, about that as well, that it wasn't always like that. It wasn't all like that. But yes, in fact, I ought to pay tribute to the sponsors, the John Player Sunday League and the Benson and Hedges Cup was another one day competition. So yeah, all sponsored by cigarette companies. I just explained to Polly. But yeah, it was a different era. And I guess it was part of my growing up. But the thought that women actually played the game as well was completely beyond comprehension going back in those times.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, my first memory of being engaged with women's cricket wasn't even in a women's game. In 1994-95, it was the Bradman Foundation Memorial Game or something like that. And the conceit was they were trying to raise money for this museum that's down in Barrow, which has become a real success story where Bradman was in when he was very young. And they put together two, I guess, international all-stars teams. It was a brilliant game. I mean, what I described before of being put in front of the television. I remember watching it just before Christmas. And the two teams were chock full with talent from across the generations. And in one of the sides, Brian Lara was playing, and this just straight off the back of his world record breaking triple 100 earlier that year against England. And he was facing Zoe Goss, who was the Australian all-rounder. Zoe Goss playing in the other side. And famously, Zoe Goss got Brian Lara out, the best player in the world. She had him both caught behind and stumped. Steve Rixon was the wicketkeeper, former Australian keeper. He took the edge and took the bails. So that was a huge moment that Zoe Goss, who, remembering no one knew anything really about women's cricket other than those who were involved in it. I think that was kind of the gist. If you played women's cricket or you had a relative playing, or if you had some connection to it as a club person, then yes, you would know about the ins and outs of women's cricket. But you look at the World Cup final in 1988, played at the MCG. I told you about my Melbourne upbringing before and how pervasive sport is in Melbourne. We pride ourselves that it's the sporting capital of the world. There's no one there, really. It doesn't have the cut through. You look at the Lords World Cup final of 1993, the women's final. There's really no one there either. Ali Mitchell tells a story about the 2009 World Cup final at North Sydney Oval when Charlotte Edwards' wonderful side won their first of two trophies that year. Of course, they won the T20 World Cup later in 2009. And Ali describes, she was there covering it, it was pretty much friends and family only, a neutral final between England and New Zealand. So with a lack of knowledge of the game, there's some exceptions to the rule. The 1997-98 World Cup final with a young Geelong Goswami in the crowd and 80,000 people there at Eden Gardens and Belinda Clark's side winning the World Cup for Australia. But typically speaking, it was a form of the game that people just didn't know much about other than the culottes that the women wore, which was a bit of a novelty, right? For guys who knew nothing but trousers, seeing women play in skirts or culottes was a noteworthy thing. And Zoe Goss was wearing the culottes when she picked up Brian Lara. So I remember a couple of years later training in Melbourne at the same ground that she was at. And I was like, wow, that's Zoe Goss. She's the bowler who got Brian Lara out. So obviously that's a sign of how immature the coverage of the women's game was and how dramatically it's changed in the generation or 30 years or so that's elapsed since.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned 94-95 because that is the only time I visited Australia. And me and my late father and my brother went over to the Sydney Test match of 1st to 5th of January 95. And so actually we were in Barrow about the 29th of December while the Boxing Day match was going on watching. And we were actually in the museum at Barrow when Shane Warne got a hat trick to finish off England's innings and retain the Ashes for Australia. So we knew at that point that our Test match would be a bit of a formality in Sydney starting a few days later. But yeah, you've provoked quite a happy memory in me mentioning that.
They did well in Sydney, didn't they? I think from memory, England drew at Sydney and then there was
a draw in those days was
a great declaration.
A couple of things. Yeah. I mean, Darren Goff had a sort of big breakthrough in that game. And then it's also famous for the declaration when Hick was 98, not out. And Mike Atherton called the team in because we needed to bowl Australia out. And then of course we ended up running out of time on the final day in the almost darkness at about 7:30 in the evening when we only, I think Graham Hick had to bowl because we couldn't put any of our quicks on. But yes, that's an old man's reminiscence from 29 years ago. I'll stop now.
And going back to kind of your career and obviously didn't quite work out playing cricket, didn't make the cut for the Aussie team, which is such a shame. But how did your kind of route into journalism happen, and how did you end up where you are now?
I'm still available for selection, Polly. We need to understand.
You've not announced your international retirement yet.
No, I turned 40 this year, which normally would be the time that people are winding down their cricket, but I'm kind of going the other way. I've made a bit of a comeback in the last couple of years, and I've never loved playing more than I do right now, which is a weird thing to say that I can't run in anymore and I bowl off spin, and it's very different to when I was a young lad trying to, you know, rough people up. But, you know, I guess it's a lifelong thing for me, a cradle to grave thing, that cricket will always be with me, and playing now as a... I'll be eligible for the veterans teams this year, which is a little bit daunting. I still feel like a young bloke, but I don't know, maybe I'm not. How did I end up in journalism? Well, the long story short is that my first career came to an abrupt end when the electors decided that the government I worked for were to be voted out of office. I worked in federal politics in Canberra for then the Prime Minister, then subsequently the Deputy Prime Minister and Federal Treasurer as a political advisor and media advisor. And in 2013... we were turfed out of office, not unreasonably. It was time for us to replenish, you could say, at that particular moment in time as a party. And that meant I had to find something else to do. And I guess it's a bit cliched to do what you know, but I knew cricket, I knew writing. I'd written a lot of speeches, and I'd had a bit of a taste of cricket writing in a speech that I wrote for the Deputy PM earlier in 2013, which was about Bodyline, the 80 years since 32, 33. And that had quite a nice bit of traction and take up in the Aussie media, not with my name on the top of the page, with his name on the top of the page, but still it was a sign to me, maybe, or at least something inside of me is like, maybe I should try this cricket writing malarkey. From there, I could probably spend this whole podcast telling the strange story that is 2014 and 2015 for me, but one thing did lead to another, and it wasn't long before I was working full-time on the circuit as a written journalist and alongside that as a broadcaster and these days having that balance between commentating the cricket on radio and telly and writing about it sometimes, but podcasting it mostly, which is the way the media has changed in the last 10 years.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about that, I suppose, that amazing risk that you took at one point in your career. I guess it seems to me it came out of a sort of dissatisfaction with the way that cricket was being covered and deciding to do something about it.
It did. It's worth noting that by that point, I was fairly well ensconced within the cricket media. It's sometimes like, you know, the story you're referring to is in 2018. So my journey, if you like, starts around 13, 14. So I'm pretty much in my stride by this point. I'd been commentating on the Sandpaper series in South Africa in early 2018. I was on air when the infamous moments played out in front of me at Newlands. But the next test series that Australia was scheduled to play without Smith and Warner, who'd been banned, of course, and Bancroft as well, was in the October of 2018. So a pretty long break, 6 month gap between overseas engagements or test engagements for the Australian men's side. And it became pretty obvious to me that there wasn't going to be a radio broadcast back to Australia. That wasn't without precedent. Indeed, the fact that there had been fewer and fewer overseas radio broadcasts into Australia had been what helped motivate me to start doing alternative commentary, which was done off the television, sometimes illegally. The inspiration for that coming from Test Match Sofa in the UK and Daniel Norcross's operation. And Daniel and I have come on to become very close friends and colleagues, and we work together all the time and speak every day. Back then, I was an admirer of his, and we did a couple of things together on the internet. We didn't really know each other, though. And I, along with Jeff, were involved in starting, Jeff Lemon, that is, who I make the final word with, were involved in starting what was known as White Line Wireless, which was the Australian alternative. So we've been doing that for a number of years. And then we got our opportunities. I had the great fortune of working for Test Match Special and for the ABC and a few other organisations around the world. But this particular series wasn't going to be covered on the ABC, the government broadcaster, so akin to the BBC, or SEN, the commercial provider who I've been working with in South Africa for a whole range of commercial and editorial reasons that I won't bore you with. So I did see an opportunity to do it myself and buy it myself. And yes, the guts of it was that I put a house deposit on the line for my then girlfriend. She's now miraculously my wife and we've got two kids. But I suppose the success of the enterprise meant that I didn't get turfed out of the apartment we were living in at the time. And we put together a radio commentary for those two test matches, the first of which ended in really exciting fashion on the final afternoon with a whole bunch of former test cricketers, Mike Hussey, Buzzard Khan, Brendan Julian, myself and Jeff as the ball by ball. There's a few of our press box colleagues working on it as well. And it was badged Wisden Test Cricket, Wisden being the magazine, Wisden Cricket Monthly, that I was a columnist for and the Australian correspondent for, and remain that to this day. So they provided me with the organ, and we brought in all the sponsors at very, very short notice and got the thing over the line, and everyone got paid, and it washed its face in business terms. And it goes on to be, I suppose, one of those stories that has a lot of different moving parts to it. And again, I don't want to spend the whole podcast talking about it necessarily, but it does make for a pretty good story in the pub or at the cricket when someone comes up to me and wants to know more about how this thing happened and how we nearly didn't get to air for lots of different reasons, about illegal streaming that we needed to do under threat of being imprisoned in Abu Dhabi and various other bits and pieces that happened along the way. But, you know, wouldn't have it any other way either nearly 6 years later.
Yeah, well, we considered doing a similar thing. It wasn't very serious, but because a lot of the England women's games haven't had radio coverage when they're aboard. So, for example, the series in New Zealand at the moment. But yeah, I don't really fancy a prison sentence. I think I've got a bit of life to live.
We'd have to stay up all night.
I should say,
well, yeah.
You'd get away with it is the truth. I don't want to give you ideas here and get you in trouble, but you would absolutely be fine doing that. The challenge would be the rights situation. My understanding is the reason why there's no radio broadcast of this series is to do with the rights arrangements from NZC and where they've landed and the willingness to do cricket through the night. Anyway, the guts of it is that if you jumped on and did one, I'll do it with you. I'll come on with you and I'll do a commentary stint with you. I'll help it make it worth your while, and we'll get away with it and everyone will think it's a nice thing. Don't worry.
Well, you have yourself a deal there. That sounds really good. I mean, my story with women's cricket is that back in 2017, so Polly was what, 11 or going 12?
Yeah, it's first year of secondary.
Yeah. And so we got two other children, and it was the first weekend of the school holidays. And so I thought I need to put a plan in place for that. And I saw that on the Lord's website, you could get tickets for the Women's World Cup final. And I thought, well, that will be its first Sunday of the school holidays. It will be a nice day out. We'll see who gets the final. And that will be great. And you know, we'll go for a nice little family day out at the cricket at Lord's and show the kids Lord's, you know, because it's such a special place. And so bought these tickets and then paid very little attention to the tournament as a whole until I saw England had a semi-final, and which they won. And so I could say, hey, we're going to go see England in a World Cup final. But we didn't know any of the players, any of the names, anything. And we just went to just the best sporting event that I'd ever been to in my whole life and loved it. And at the end of it, England lifted the World Cup. I remember saying to you, Polly, you can say now for the rest of your life that you have seen England lift a World Cup. And there are not many people that can say that or in the future will be able to say it either.
Yeah, it's a good point. Nice technical point there on the way through about seeing something like that as such a young kid, I guess. I've got two little girls as well, a one-year-old and a four-year-old. And I took my four-year-old to Lord's for the first time last year. And she's scared witless of the WG Grey sculpture. She calls him the scary man, which I suppose is right with the big beard and all the rest of it. But I live in hope that she'll want to come and join me at cricket games when she's older. I'm pretty sure she will. She's just taken to sitting on the sofa watching. She was watching the test match from Bangladesh with me yesterday, which is a pretty good sign, I think, even though she doesn't quite know what's going on as yet. But no, that was a hugely significant day in the history of women's cricket. I was a fair way into covering the women's game by that point. I had the great fortune of being part of the Guardian's coverage for that particular match and had been covering the whole tournament up and down the country for the previous 4.5 weeks. And it was a very emotional day. I think anyone who'd had anything to do with women's cricket back when it didn't have the same take up, I mentioned before, 93, 2009, is just two reference points. There are many, many more. Those who had been there like me, maybe it was probably my third year of covering women's cricket, it was impossible not to get swept up in the emotion of being at Lord's at close to capacity. I'm not going to say it was full, because the truth is the pavilion wasn't full, but the public seating was for the most part. And the noise that was emanating from beneath us, the way the press box shook when Anya was taking those wickets at the end. People, myself included, were in tears at the end. It was just, it was overwhelming. And it was very special. And to have been there and witnessed it, for that to be your first memory of going to the cricket, Polly, that is really cool. You should tell Anya that at some point when you come across her. She'll really rate that too, I'm sure. But that generation of England players having had that moment at Lord's, and it was the most watched cricket match in the world that year. That day of cricket was watched by 200 million people around the world. Now, that's because India were in the final, right? Let's call it for what it is. But still, no day of international cricket, men's or women's, received more eyeballs in 2017 than the Women's World Cup final. And that's something that I think proved to a lot of people, cliched as it is, if you build it, they will come. The first edition of the Kia Super League in 2016 was not on television, even finals day, because there was a little bit, and I think people would acknowledge now, there was a little bit of, maybe the cricket won't be very good. Maybe it just won't be very good. Maybe we don't really want this on telly, right? After 2017, that was gone. No one was saying that anymore, or no one that mattered was saying that anymore. There was a view that the game had matured. Professional contracts for the national side had been in place since 2014, which was the precondition for them, beating Australia in the group stage and giving themselves that run to the final. And professional contracts were starting in the domestic game. Now, I mean, what have we got? 90 professional contracts across the domestic structure, I think I'm right in saying. Maybe that includes the nationals. Either way, it's a huge number compared to the way it was. And that'll change yet further from 2025 when the next stage of the professional plan is put in place by the ECB in conjunction with the first class county. So, when looking at all of that, that storyline of women's cricket, where it's been and where it's going, so many roads lead back to the 2017 World Cup final at Lord's and then subsequently the 2020 World Cup final at the MCG when 86,500 people rocked up, remembering, as I said before, in 1988, there would have been no more than, say, 1,000 or 2,000 people there. So, yeah, there are these moments in time where people's attitudes change so significantly, and I love that. I love the fact that you saw it on the Lord's website and you're like, no, I'm going to be part of this. And that it turned into a moment in history is something that you two will have forever. And I think that's really special.
Yeah. And pivotal for you because it's kind of shaped everything you've done since then as well.
Yeah, that is very true. I think it's quite funny as well, because I guess I just presumed it was normal when I turned up to Lord's and there were all these people, and then went to a women's cricket game a couple of years later and there were maybe 200 people. I was like, oh, okay, yeah. What's gone wrong? But then you looked at the Ashes last summer and the ODI Sabres was sold out. I understand, yes, it was smaller grounds, but Edgbaston, the atmosphere there was incredible. The Oval, Lords, even the Test match at Trent Bridge, getting decent crowds in there. It's becoming a lot more sustainable. And I think it really helped that England did quite well in that Ashes series, of course, didn't win. But, I mean, the Aussies didn't win either. They just retained it. So it's all good. But on kind of the topic of Australian women's cricket, the longevity and the success of that team has just been incredible. And, of course, last summer, they didn't do as well as they normally do. But what do you think some of those reasons are for their success in global cricket?
Investment. It's interesting that England actually got there first on professional deals for the national team. They got there, I think, 6 months earlier, I want to say. I think they got there in this one full season ahead of Australia for the national team, right? But from there, Australia put the foot down. So the agreement of 2017, the memorandum of understanding agreement that Australia struck, that was seeing the average salary for a women's player in the Australian team making $200,000. Had you said that 5 years earlier, you would have been, what? How's that even in our wildest dreams possible? That happened in the space of like 1.5 pay cycles. And this latest deal in 2023 takes it to a whole new level. When you fold in money that can be accrued playing in the WPL and in the 100 and on the circuit more generally, it's expected that there'll be Australian players this year earning $1 million a year, right? So that's just in like one decade from really nothing. I wouldn't say paying to play when they were playing international cricket, but certainly that dilapidated county system with small groups and five divisions, and it wasn't serious really. You can't look at that as an appropriate breeding ground for an international side. What England's done there with centralizing their talent reflects how it is in Australia, where you've got seven sides playing in the WNCL. That includes the ACT, so the states plus one more compared to the men. The WBBL, which is now into, well, my arithmetic might be off here. I think it's season 9 next year. It started in 15-16. And, you know, from little things, big things grow. The salaries that were being made in that first year of the WBBL weren't too crash hot. But now, again, they're quite lucrative. They are very competitive when it comes to recruiting the best women's talent and the exposure that it gets in turn. So that first season in WBBL, I mentioned before that the KSL year one, 2016, it didn't get on Sky. Channel 10 did have the rights in 15-16 for about maybe 12 or 15 women's games. Most of them were doubleheaders. And there was a view that, oh, we'll just put it on the secondary channel because, like, you know, it's a new thing. People might find it. They might not find it. It doesn't really matter. It's more about, like, the symbol of putting women's domestic cricket on television. That's more important than how many people actually watch it. But the numbers were incredible. So much so that it was in Channel 10's commercial interest to put it on their main channel. So the semifinals and the final were on the main station, right, for the network in question. And again, that's another little turning point where people are, oh, right. So if we put it on, if we give it a chance to breathe, people will engage with it. They will turn it on. But yeah, the investment piece to this, you can't underestimate just how much money is being put in at lower levels as well. Participation following suit, the state contracts, which are so competitive, the WBBL, the national contracts, it has developed what's, I'm going to use a controversial term here, the gap. Some people don't like talking about the gap. It gets them quite cross because the suggestion there is that Australia should win every game, and if they don't win a game, then there's scrutiny on them for not winning. Well, they should win just about every game they play because they're paid so much more. They were already ahead to begin with. Then you inject the funds. There has been something of a multi-speed economy in women's cricket. You've got Australia, you've got England trailing them in terms of investment, although doing a terrific job in catching up relative to where they were. You've got India pouring in money to women's cricket for the first time properly over the last 4 or 5 years, arguably since that 2017 World Cup, actually. I remember, as a quick aside, Mithali Raj, the Indian skipper, when that tournament started, had about 2,500 Twitter followers. By the end of it, she had 250,000 Twitter followers or something ridiculous. It was one tournament where India, the Indian giant was awoken in women's cricket. And now we see the commercial payoff from that with the WPL. So there's India there. And interestingly, New Zealand have dropped off. Now, New Zealand in women's cricket terms were always part of the big three. It was New Zealand won the World Cup in 2000, the 50-over World Cup. They made a host of World Cup finals, including a couple in 2009 against England. They lost both of them. But they were a really strong side. When the WBBL started, you can make a case that the New Zealand overseas players were the best overseas players in the tournament, right? But they haven't had the same levels of investment. I know they have equal match fees in New Zealand now, and they've got bigger contracts than they had before, but that investment hasn't flushed through the system into domestic cricket in quite the same way. There isn't the competitive tension with the national team in the way we see in Australia or England or indeed now India. And I think we've seen with New Zealand a side that systematically struggled at major tournaments, and I don't think that's unrelated. So, yeah, if the satellite view, the 30,000 feet view, is that it's to do with money. But with money, you get more sophisticated broadcasting, you get more dedicated backroom staff, you get better coverage, and ultimately you get a game which feels more like men's cricket. And I'm not saying that women's cricket needs to look like men's cricket to be successful, but what you get is something that when you're a little boy or a little girl growing up, when you're watching the two games side by side, you wouldn't know it's a boy sport. Air quotes, boys sport. When I was a kid growing up, probably the same for you, Polly, cricket was a boys sport. My little girls don't, or my eldest, she would never know. She would never know that cricket until very recently was a boys sport. That would never be in her vernacular. And that's not just because I'm her dad. It's because that when she flicks on the telly, she's just as likely to see a women's game as she is to see a men's game. And that wouldn't have been remotely possible without the investment in the game that's taken place and where Australia have been the standard bearer.
Yeah, it seems to me that the investment needs to be not just in the national team, but also in the domestic side, the grassroots side, and then, as you say, in the media coverage side. So at every single level, the game is being promoted to people. And so you've got, you know, kids your daughter's age who are experiencing it because it's being shown to them. And then there's this structure within clubs for them to join that and to be a participant. And then the domestic structure is there for for the best of those people in the clubs to step up and try their hand at regional cricket and so on. And so therefore it becomes a bit more sustainable. And maybe that's what's missing in New Zealand, where there isn't that kind of supply line coming through. And I guess, you know, they're a smaller country, aren't they? Bless them as well. So it's a bit more tricky for them.
Yeah, it is and it isn't. I mean, they're shown with their men's program and earlier with their women's program that they, and again, this is a patronising term, but punch above their weight. So I don't think it's inconceivable that New Zealand could climb back up and be as competitive. But I mean, I know they knocked off England a couple of days ago, by the way, yes. As we're recording this. It's not impossible for them to be a very competitive side, but it's more about you look at them across the last 6 or 7 years when other countries have been dumping in much more money. And you see that gap again recognised. And look, Australia should be proud of the gap, by the way. It should be something they take great joy in, that they've been able to take their existing advantage and build on top of it. But the more mindful players in that dressing room, I take Megan Shute, for example. Megan Shute, who's a very smart person, who's been around for a very long time, she is of the view that women's cricket needs to get better across the board, that Australia needs to be competed with more often than not. And there'll be a transition there, right? Because there are a lot of people, the Australian women's side don't get any negative coverage. It's gushing with praise, and fair enough, given how successful they've been, but it's not covered in the way that sports teams are normally covered. It's mostly extremely positive stuff. You very, very, very rarely see any criticism of any of the players. And when you do, there's a backlash online because of it, right? Because they've been so successful. What you want to probably get to is what Heather Knight often talks about, where when women are criticized, when her team is criticized, she takes it as a badge of honor. She's like, oh, this is a good thing. People are paying attention and smacking us in the same way they'd smack the men's team. That's good. That's, again, a price signal to people who are growing up following the game for the first time, that there isn't a discrepancy in the way that men's cricket is covered compared to women's cricket when people are writing about it or talking about it on podcasts or talking about it on broadcast or whatever it is. And I think commentators are very aware of that when there's something that isn't up to scratch, you need to say it in the same way that you would say it about men's. The days when patronising lovey-dovey bullshit is over for women's cricket, and that's a great thing. That is a terrific thing. That the kid gloves can be put away. Women's sport, women's cricket, is a serious business and should get covered in a serious way. And I think that those who do, it's to their credit. And all of the people you see on TV, on Sky, for example, they share that view. I mean, I've worked with those guys, and they know that. And by guys, I mean men and women. I'm just using the collective guys there. They know that it's their job to say exactly what they see in front of them, just as they would for a men's game.
And that's the definition of equality, really, isn't it? It's being as prepared to criticise one as you are the other. And I guess maybe the rise of women's sport reflects maybe in a wider society a more of a priority that's been given to equality maybe over the last 10, 20 years. And women's sport is a kind of reflection of that, in possibly in the Western world, but not in all parts of the world, which maybe leads us to talk a little bit about Afghanistan, which is this kind of we don't quite understand it, and why the ICC don't implement their own rules on this matter. And it seems to me that this is one of the real issues that needs to come to a head at some point within the whole game of cricket, as to why equality is really important in some places, but not so important in others.
It's just commercially inconvenient is the short way of explaining it. The ICC World Cups are sold on the basis of the full members being available to play, and Afghanistan are a full member. So if you just look at it through the way that revenue is made at ICC level, the vast majority of it is in men's World Cups. That's the cash cow, right? In terms of how they make money, which gets distributed across their membership, by the way. But I'm not saying they hoard it in an ivory tower in Dubai or something like that. It's more that this is their opportunity. That's why you see more and more men's global tournaments. The Champions Trophy's back next year. We've got T20 tournaments every second year, the World Cup every fourth year. So every year there is a men's World Cup, because that is the chance to make the most amount of money, right? And Afghanistan being excluded from that process would have an effect on that. That's the really simple way of explaining it. And it's a fight that full members have shown little appetite of fighting. Australia have declined to play Afghanistan in bilateral series twice now, and they've been working in close conjunction with the federal government on that, and that's commendable that they've taken that stance. But we shouldn't be naive to the fact that both of those bilateral series, well, the one last year was going to clash with the IPL. Australia were never playing in that. They were never going to pull their players out of the IPL. Oh, let's go to Afghanistan for three games. That was never happening regardless. So that was an easy one for them not to play. And the series later this year, you could argue, is much the same. It's after the 20-over World Cup. So it's in the FTP. But and I'm being very cynical there, but just acknowledging that that these decisions aren't completely divorced from the cricket circumstances around them. And ultimately at those ICC events, Australia had played Afghanistan both in 2022 and famously in 2023 with the Glenn Maxwell miracle. Both of those matches were played after Australia had said they'd be, they wouldn't, well, I think 2022 might've just came before it actually, but nonetheless, they said they wouldn't play Afghanistan. But the caveat there is it's in bilateral cricket. They'll still play them in global tournaments. So, look, as for your wider point about implementing their own rules, I just don't see that changing when the commercial realities are aligned to seeing Afghanistan playing. And the fact that they had a really good World Cup last year in India, the men, that is, there is no women's sides, it's a moot point. But they played so well in that tournament and weren't far from qualifying for the semifinals. That'll only underscore that point. And the fact that they've got a really good cricketing story, remembering the guys in that dressing room, a lot of them have played under considerable personal risk, and their families as well. It's not about the players. It's about the bigger picture. But yeah, there's a misalignment at the moment, and I don't see it being resolved.
I've got a final question. You're of course based in London now. And so how would you feel about your 4-year-old daughter expressing the want to be a cricketer and the potential of playing for England in the future?
Oh, we should be so lucky. Look, I consider myself a Londoner really now. I've lived here for a long time, and my wife's British, and Winnie speaks with a pronounced London accent, and I'm sure Peggy will as well when she's gibbering away. You can almost hear it when she says, "Mama, Dada," there is an English more than an Australian twang there. If she wants to play cricket, that'd just be terrific. If she wants to kind of be part of the game, that'd be so cool. And the fact that I've involved myself so much in women's cricket in the last 10 years of my professional life and have tried to beat the drum to the extent to which I have. And going back to what I said before, by the way, I love the fact that there are women's World Cups now, and it's got this whole media ecosystem there. It doesn't kind of need everyone to be part of every tournament. It's got its own thing going on. It's really cool. But yeah, if she, when she's 6 or 7 or 8 or 9, like me, she's got her cricket bat at home that she picks up, and if she says to me, "I want to go and play cricket for the local side, or go and join Dynamos and All Stars and that kind of thing," I'll be the happiest dad going around, because the very fact that cricket is a game for everyone and is seen increasingly that way is to the credit of cricket and to the credit of people within it and to the credit of the women who were doing it and the girls who are playing it before it was fashionable, before it was profitable, before it was cool. And look, the benefits are being enjoyed across the game now. So if my girls play, full stop, that'd make me very happy. If they go on to express an allegiance to England, I guess that's only natural, because I don't expect we'll be living in Australia anytime soon. But as Winnie always says when it's put to her, I'm Australian too. So she knows that she's got a foot in both camps. And I did buy her a bit of Matilda's paraphernalia when I was in Australia last week as well. So she's been wearing that around the house, a playing shirt. So she knows that she gets the benefit of both.
Well, yeah, we are running out of time. So thank you very much for your time. Brilliant for our podcast.
Yes, thank you, Adam, so much. You've been very, very generous with your time, and it's been great to meet you.
My absolute pleasure. Good luck with the project as you continue making these episodes. Anything I can do to help, please do sing out. And yes, thanks for having me.
That was such a good chat.
It was really good. It was one of those where you just felt we could chat for hours. Zoom, unfortunately, has a time limit. And also Adam Collins has a time limit. He's a very busy man. So, yeah, but no, our thanks go to Adam, because so interesting, so many different branches of our love for cricket. But
and he was just so nice. He was so friendly.
Yeah,
and
he's very professional as well. I had a little backdrop and everything. I was very
need to get one of those. Yeah, why didn't you get one of those for us?
I'm sorry. It's not like I do everything else around here. Too busy cleaning bathrooms and kitchens. I am available for hire in Australia if you would like to house me. But yeah, really, really good chat. And we're going to take a little break for a week.
We're going to Northumberland.
We're going to Northumberland. We are back in the Northeast. We're going to try and help with, I mean, Durham and Northumberland. It's Durham, but Project Darwin.
Yeah.
We are going to pitch the Dragons, I think. Yeah. We'll influence them. But so yeah, next week there won't be an episode. However, good news, we have got episodes in the can. We have got a couple of interviews ready for after Easter. So we will be back the week after next. But in the meantime, you can follow our social media. So our Instagram and TikTok is Naughty Child Podcast and our Twitter is Naughty Child Podcast.